Well, good morning.
Good morning.
I don't know if I need to say, is this thing on, or whether or not if I say, can you hear me, that's a different question than is this microphone on. So, all right, today we're going to be finishing up Genesis and moving into the rest of the Pentateuch. We have, actually we'll get into several parts of the Pentateuch, especially Exodus, but there is a reason why we're spending a lot of time, maybe a little bit more time than is allotted in our series of classes on the book of Genesis and the Pentateuch, but we'll try to finish that this week as much as, I would say humanly possible, as much as it is possible for me to finish it, and that might be a little different explanation as well. So, five things I have asked you in regards to the class to either bring or participate in. You remember what those five things are? Okay, number one, bring your Bible. All right. Number two, what? Pray specifically for the class, for the students, for the teachers. Study that we do. Number three? Read what? 10 chapters every day will get you through the Old Testament in 3 months, and we've set aside 3 months, for this. I've been telling you 72 hours. I made a slight mistake on that. Recheck the numbers. For an average reader, it's 74 hours. So it's going to take you a couple hours extra on your reading scale. So you need to set aside 74 instead of 72 hours in the next 3 months to accomplish that. Number four. Okay, be thirsty. By the way, be thirsty when you're here, but especially be thirsty when you're contemplating, meditating, reading the Word of God. Be thirsty for it. And then there was a combination of two things that we added along with that, and it was, participate is always a good thing. We didn't list that one, but we will next week. That's number six on your list, by the way. Sorry? Notebook, pen and paper, right? Listen, the best part of Bible study is to remember what you were actually going to study. And if you're like me, you have a tendency that when you're in class and somebody says something, then you remember it right then. But by the time you get home, you're thinking, what did that person say? What was it that I was going to study? And it bothers you all week long. So I'm just suggesting this is going to help not bother you all week long. So you just jot it down so that you can have that for further Bible study. Okay, those are some of the things that we definitely wanted to get through. There are a couple of things that I wanted to mention with regards to the book of Genesis before we finish with our study of the book of Genesis. You know, there when you look at the book of Genesis, there are just several things that are important. And I guess until we started this study, it didn't really dawn on me. You know, you have a lot of facts in your head, but you don't sometimes connect the dots. You don't put those things together until you come up with a particular study. And so until this study, I guess I had never really put these numbers together. And I want you to listen to these numbers. There's over 4,100 years recorded in Bible history. Okay, 4,100 years. You have the 4,000 years of the Old Testament, and then you have basically the 100 years of the New Testament. So you have about 4,100 years recorded in the Bible. Over one half of that is recorded in the book of Genesis. Almost 2,300 years is recorded in the book of Genesis. Now we're talking about the entirety of God's record of the scheme of redemption from Genesis all the way to Revelation. And almost half of that is recorded in the book of Genesis. About a little over 1,800 years is recorded in the rest of the New Testament, or the rest of the Bible, excuse me. 2,000 years of the 2,300 years in the book of Genesis are in the first 11 chapters. Now, I have gone through and I've looked at all of the numbers from all of the patriarchs, and I've done that study of numbering every, but it didn't click in my head that half, or about half, of the entire book of Genesis, about half of the Bible, history, is recorded in the first 11 chapters. It dawns on me that God recorded, God skims over with 11 chapters all of that history. That it was unnecessary for us to know a lot of the events that were taking place in the first 11 chapters of the book, or that time sphere, the first 2,000 years of recorded history. And so when you come to certain phrases, for example, Enoch walked with God, that may be outside of Noah and Adam, that may be the longest historical phrase that we have about anybody in the first 11 chapters. And so it really didn't dawn on me as we were covering some of this material, and I've covered it for a long time, that when you put the numbers, just the numbers up there, it's amazing in the first 11 chapters how much time has gone by since the creation of Adam in regards to that. And so I thought that was pretty interesting in regards to that, and something that was important for us to reference, at least in our minds, as we're talking about book by book. Now, the Pentateuch is a book that is written by Moses. I had some other paperwork here too that I wanted to make sure that I got to. Written by Moses, and no, I'm not going to get to that. That's too much information. It's written by Moses. All of this book, from Genesis to the book of Deuteronomy, sometime during the period of the wilderness wandering. Of course, Numbers is going to be authored a little bit later, down toward the very end of that. As to whether or not the last chapter is authored by Moses or whether or not it is authored by Joshua does not concern me, except to say that it's recorded in the book of Moses. Now, whether or not Joshua appended that with his death doesn't really concern me, because I know this. All of it is by the inspiration of God. And so whether or not Moses penned it before he went up on the mount, or whether or not Joshua did later, does not really concern me as far as book by book is concerned. But the book of Genesis then contains a great deal of information for us, and the first 11 chapters basically dealing with the beginning of all things. And then from chapter 12 on, and you really do have, why God chose Israel to be His special people, and how God chose Israel to be His special people, are the two questions, the primary questions that are going to be answered in the book of Genesis. Now, there are a great number of things that are listed in the book of Genesis about the Messiah. We've already talked about Genesis 3:15 and the fact that Christ is the seed of woman, but he was also of the seed line of Seth, chapter 4 and verse number 25. He was of the seed line of Shem from Genesis 9:27. He was a descendant of Abraham, of Isaac, and Jacob, and he is from the tribe of Judah. Genesis 49 and verse number 10. And so as far as messianic items, those are some things that you probably, and some scriptures that you probably should have written down as far as the book of Genesis is concerned. I don't want to miss the fact that with the promise that is given to Abraham, that is reiterated to Isaac and Jacob, I don't want to miss the fact that there are actually three promises in regards to that, that there is a land promise. Genesis 15 and verse number 8, he identifies the land promise. In Genesis 13 and verse number 6, remember, he says to Abraham, I'm going to make of thee a great nation. Now in order to have a nation, you need territory, you need, citizens, and, you need a law. So, the book of Exodus is going to be, the follow-up on that great promise. But there's also another promise that is given to Abraham that is from Abraham, but would not come about at the same time that the land and the nation promise would come about, and that is the seed promise. And Genesis 12, verses 1 and following, that of him he's going to make him a great nation, that all that Abraham would have a great name, that through him all the nations of the earth would be blessed. Those are important elements in the book of Genesis when you study the book of Genesis. So any questions or comments dealing with the book of Genesis before we move on? Yes. They have to be descendants from Adam and Eve. There's a couple of statements that you probably should have marked in your Bible. If you'll turn with me to Genesis chapter 3, Genesis chapter 3 and verse number 20. There's a couple. One of them is in 1 Corinthians 15 concerning Adam. But here it says, and Adam called his wife's name Eve because she was what? The mother of all living. And so if Eve is the mother of all living, then she is the mother of all of those that Cain is going to go join, right? By the way, there's a lot of history that we just don't have. That would be one of them. What is it? 1 Corinthians chapter 15. I'll have to go over there. Let me get you that reference. I thought it was verse 45. It says the first man, Adam, was made a living soul. Let's see. Well, I'll give you that reference later. I thought I had it highlighted in 1 Corinthians 15, but if that's not it, somebody else can grab that verse for me. But you have Adam and Eve, and they are the first that are there, and they through them all life, all human life springs forth. So those are the ones that I would have there, and I think probably the Genesis chapter 3 verse would grab all of that as well. And from that perspective, then you have a very limited view of where everybody came from. They all came from Adam and Eve. Okay. All right. Let's move into the book of Exodus. Then the couple of things about this book that are important for us to remember and keep in mind, and this book, by the way, all of the titles that we have for these books are not Hebrew titles, even though we're dealing with Hebrew books or books that were originally written in Hebrew. They're not the Hebrew titles, they're the Greek titles that were given to them. Hebrews did things a little bit different. They titled the book by the first word or the first few words that automatically title of that. You know, some I was telling somebody the other day that some old preachers used to do that in their sermon outline books. I have several outline books in my library, and I have one in particular. It's called The Power of the Gospel. And when I when I first picked it up to purchase it, I thought, oh great, this is going to be an excellent book on what the Bible is and the power of the gospel. And it was it's a pretty good sized book, about an inch, maybe an inch and a half thick. And I thought, this is going to be great. When I opened it up and began to scan through it, I soon realized that the title came from the first sermon outline that was listed. And there's 100 sermon outlines in there on 1,000 different, well, not 1,000, but on 100 different topics. And so the book is not about the power of the gospel. It's just entitled The Power of the Gospel. Well, that's the way the Hebrews did things. Now, Greeks, and you and I, when we write a book and we title a book, we try to give some indication of what's actually in the book. For example, So You Want to Be Happy, the book that we've had with Brother Eric Lyons, that's the content. That's not just the first statement of the book, that's the content. And so the book of Genesis, then, it's given the name Genesis because it is about the origin of things. The book of Exodus is given to that book because it is about the exodus of the children of Israel from Egyptian bondage. And that's the main part of that particular book. And so forth and so forth. The book of Leviticus is all about the Levitical priesthood. And so it's about the Levites and more particularly the priesthood in regards to that. The book of Numbers, guess what? There are two numberings in the book of Numbers. And that plays a valuable part to the reliability of the children of Israel in battle format. So that they can carry out the work of God. And men range above 20 that were of the ability to go to war. And so there's a numbering of the people. Now, that's not a numbering of everybody in there. In chapter 1 of the book of Numbers, you have this numbering, but it's not everybody that was there. It was everybody, the men that were able to go to war. That was the number of those. And so when you get down, what is it, Numbers, I guess it doesn't matter, in chapter 1, and it comes to the number of 603,550 on that first numbering, then when you get down to that, that's the fighting force of Israel. And Josh has emphasized several times in our Bible classes that the number of the children of Israel would have been somewhere between 2 to 4 million people then. If that's the fighting force that we're talking about, and I think most realize that there's the book of Deuteronomy, the second law, not necessarily another law, not even in reality a repeat of the same law. It is an admonition of a new generation to keep the law of Moses, and there are some specific things that are stated to them in regards to that. And so that's how the not all books are entitled that way. By the way, when you get through with Deuteronomy, you come up to what? Hang on. Joshua, right? Okay, you come to Joshua. Joshua is not entitled because of the main event in the book, but because of the main character in the book, right? A lot of books are entitled either by the main character or the main event in the book, and then some, and Joshua be included in that, but also the author of the book. You see, some of them, especially when you get down to the minor prophets, even the major prophets, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Daniel, and then you get into the minor prophets. Not just the main character a lot of times, but that's the individual who is authoring the book. The book of Habakkuk, for example, begins, this is the burden of Habakkuk. In other words, he is the one who is authoring this particular book. It's not just the fact that he is a main character in there. So that may be important for us just to jot down in our minds as far as that. Now, the book of Genesis, we've already emphasized, covers a huge amount of time space when we're talking about the 4,000 years of history. the book of Exodus covers about, a whole lot less time, the difference between Genesis and Exodus in time frame, I think, is supposed to be about 300 years, just between the time frame between those that would separate those individuals. But you don't have a lot of time in regards to the advancement of time in the book of Exodus. And so if they go in, the sojourning takes place somewhere around 19 to 14, then you have just a few hundred years that you're talking about of them actually being in Egypt. And and by the way, most of that time frame, we don't have a lot recorded for us. Several hundred years go by without much being recorded at all in the book of Exodus. All of a sudden, we go from Joseph all the way to Moses. It's not as if Joseph is the, or Moses is the son of Joseph. There's a lot that has taken place in the statement when it says, Exodus chapter 1, it says in verse number 6, "And Joseph died, and all his brethren, and all that generation, and the children of Israel were fruitful and increased abundantly and multiplied and waxed exceedingly mighty, and the land was filled with them. Now there arose a new king over Egypt, a new king that knew not Joseph." Well, there's a lot of time frame that has taken place, generations of time that have taken place in this particular time frame. And so it is good to keep in mind when we're talking about the book of Exodus, there's a lot of time frame involved in that. Now, couple of things about the book of Exodus. If you're just looking at the book of Exodus, everything about the book of Exodus is focused upon what's going to cause the children of Israel, that's the first 14 chapters, to exit out of Egypt, and then what they did after they exited Egypt is the rest of it. Some of it includes some of the information that Moses is given as they are surrounding Sinai. They come to Sinai and the law is given, but at the same time, a part of that is the instruction about building the tabernacle. Part of that is about all of the furniture that's in the tabernacle, and involved in that then is some information about what we're going to find in the book of Leviticus is the Levitical work itself. Some of that information is definitely involved in that. If we just looked at some of the items that you're going to come across when you read through the book of Exodus, maybe you can help add to this particular list, by the way. But here's a list of items. You're going to come across the commissioning of Moses, right? That's one of the first things that you're going to come up with, is that Moses is commissioned. This is chapters 3 and 4. Moses is commissioned to go back. Remember, he has fled. He goes back, and that commission was given to him by God at the burning bush. Now, there's a lot of things that go on between chapters 1 through 4 that we're not going to be able to get to. This is not a study of the book of Exodus, remember. So the 10 plagues, okay? Remember that Exodus 12 and verse number 12 may be the key scripture in regards to the first event, the first major event of the Exodus itself, the 10 plagues. What was all of this about? In fact, there's a gentleman, I can't remember his name, I found a good study online by one of our brethren that has an entire study just on the 10 plagues, and that's a good study in and of itself. But chapter 12 and verse number 12 identifies that this, these plagues and everything that is happening is not really about Moses and Pharaoh. Regardless of what Cecil B. DeMille wanted us to think, regardless of what any other motion picture person wanted us to, it was not about a rival between Moses and Pharaoh, and it was about God and all of the gods of Egypt. The God and all of the gods of Egypt. This was, Egypt was to be a battle zone between God and all of the false gods of Egypt. And this gentleman, I wish I could remember his name, but you can do a search on that. He lists all of the gods of Egypt and how each of these plagues were in relationship to that. Yes, sir. The number 12 would be included in that, and derivatives of those often, and especially in apocalyptic literature, when it's used in figurative language especially. But you see that number cropping up multiple times, don't you? And there is no doubt that this is God's complete annihilation of the false gods of Egypt, right? And I think absolutely so. Yes, sir. That is true, yes. And by the way, we find that picking up when you get to Joshua and them coming into the land of promise. You remember that they send in spies, and those spies end up in Rahab's house. And what was Rahab's knowledge of these spies? Exactly what Josh was talking about here. I'm sorry? We know what you did in Egypt, and exactly. And so God set that example. By the way, I wonder if that. I know that oftentimes you spoke of those hornets that go beforehand. I wonder if a part of that is not just the knowledge of what God had done to the pinnacle of society at that time. Listen, if he can do that to Egypt, who are the Canaanites, right? Who are the Hittites and the Hivites and the Jebusites, all those other ites that are in the land? Who would those people be to stand against the God that goes before Moses and Joshua? You see, and so I wonder if some of that is not, hey, here's your hornet, fear, right? I mean, if you put that in the hearts and minds. By the way, this kind of interests me. Numbers chapter 13. We're skipping ahead. Well, I'm trying to show the relationship of what Joshua is saying here, because I think that both of these points are good points that need to be made when we're studying this book. But you think about Numbers 13 and 14, the children of Israel come up to Kadesh Barnea, probably one of the most iconic scenes in all of the Old Testament. Quoted more in the New Testament, the scene, than any other scene that I can think of in the entire Bible, save maybe the Genesis account itself. It is this scene where they come up to Kadesh Barnea, the southern portion of the land of promise, and they establish the spies. The spies go in, and this is not Joshua's spies, this is Moses' spies. And they go in, and they come back, and you remember the report of the spies? Sent in 12, one from each, and you remember what their report was? Okay, it was indeed the land of milk. It's exactly as God said it would be, right? And they could say, as they carried the cluster of grapes between them, they could say, see, here's the evidence. It is a land flowing with milk and honey. Nevertheless, there are giants in the land, right? Now, somebody look up Numbers 13 and verse 33. If you don't have this, etched in the, at least this verse, I don't mean memorize, you can memorize it, but etched in the chalkboard of your mind, you need to have it there. Now stop there. Where were we grasshoppers? Where? No, where? In our own sight. In our heads, we feared them. See, and listen, I made this point before, but Joshua and Caleb could not see the giants because God was standing in their way. The 10 spies that we don't know their name, they're listed, but I don't know of anybody who's memorized their names. They could not see God because the giants were standing in their way. It is, fear is a matter of perspective. Now then, go back to the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Hivites. When God dealt with Egypt, He was sending a message to the whole world. Fear me. Fear my people. By the way, and I only mention that, I only stay on that a little bit longer than probably what we should, because if you're just asking me, I think one of the issues that we face on a regular basis is, who are we and who is our enemy? And what right does any enemy have to do to stand in the way of God's people? You think about this. Now, God told Israel, this land belongs to you. Now I've gone to preaching. I'm going to have to quit real quickly here. God said, this land belongs to you. But they had to go in and take it, right? So, on a mountain in Galilee, Jesus stood with His disciples. And He said, go ye into all the world. By the way, that world belongs to whom? God. He says, all authority, Jesus does. All authority had been given unto me in heaven and on earth. Go ye therefore. You go into all the world, you make disciples, you preach the gospel. And I feel as if oftentimes we shrink back. That would be Hebrews 10, verse 38 and 39. But we shrink back because we fear our enemy that is out there. We think too much of our enemy that is out there. But sometimes, by the way, this is another issue. We want to be like, that's the book of Judges, by the way. We want to be like our enemy that is out there. Yes, sir. Don't get me preaching more now, okay? Okay. Because in the same way, and I think this is a great point. Did everybody hear that question? Why would we fear an enemy that's already been defeated? I told you not to get me preaching. And why would the Israelites fear the Canaanites? Who cares whether or not they have giants in the land? Who cares whether or not the sons of Anak was there? God has just destroyed the greatest nation upon the face of the earth. Exactly. And that's before the wilderness wandering, right? He's already, listen, Joshua, Moses has already stood up, to the Amalekites, and all that Moses did was raise the rod of God high so that Joshua could, now they had to fight, but as long as that rod was, as long as God, they were doing what God said do, they were victorious. And so I think this is a legitimate question. Why would we fear someone who's already been defeated? Where did they weep, Jerry? Yeah. It does. And I think it's Hebrews chapter 4 that mentions that they wept in their tents. They wept in their tents. But at night, that's what is implied. In other words, this grumbling and murmuring did not take place out in the open. But look at verse number 22 of chapter 14. We're way off here, by the way. In case y'all don't know this, we are way off from our lesson. But now here's my, listen, you know me right already. So you know there are times we're going to get off. That's just the way it is. I think it's 14:22. What was the different spirit that he had? Okay, it is godly. We can put it under that category. That is true. But give me the next phrase. Well, God defines his term. When he says he had, when God says that he had a different spirit, he defines what that spirit is, right? He followed me fully. That is the spirit God is looking for. That will allow a man to conquer giants that stand before him. Now, as to why, I think that, by the way, that Josh doesn't make a good sermon. All right, let's see here. We're not going to get to Leviticus. By the way, we're supposed to be through with the Pentateuch by Wednesday night, and I'm not sure that we're going to get there. But that's okay. We'll travel at our own pace, okay? All right, so we got the 10 plagues in the book of Exodus. You have the beginning of the Passover, the reason for the Jewish feast of the Passover. You have the opening of the Red Sea, by the way, tremendous scenes that are referred to in the New Testament. You have the instruction given on the tabernacle. We talked about the building of the tabernacle. And then God, chapter 40, verses 34 through 38, I think is a good place for us to end. If someone will read that for us. Chapter 40, verses 34 through 38, and this will close the book of Exodus. But the scene is the temple has been built, or the tabernacle, excuse me, has been built, and all things are ready, but there's one thing that is missing. And what is missing is filled here for us in these verses. Verses 34 through 38. Okay, so the only thing that was missing in this tabernacle was what? Okay, the glory of the Lord, right? That was the only thing missing. And this was going to be a very important element in regards to Israel's worship. That's the next book, Leviticus, that we're going to get into. By the way, the book of Leviticus covers absolutely no time frame as far as their movement is concerned. They're at the same place at the beginning of the book that they are at the end of the book. And we just figured out, or it was just stated why they were there. As long as the cloud was there, there was no movement. So they were guided by God in all of their movements. Okay? But we're going to find them at Sinai when we open up the book of Leviticus, and we're going to find them at Sinai at the end of the book of Leviticus. Okay, that covers two books out of the Pentateuch, and we're supposed to be through with all of them by this Wednesday. So, well, we'll just cover it at our own time pace. I started to say, speeding hat on and get ready, but we'll just cover it at our own pace. All right? Yes, ma'am. I think it was about a year and a half to 18 months. Is that right? Off the top of my head? Yeah, okay. About a year and a half to 2 years was the time frame. By the way, and I think that's a good question, because I think sometimes when we read through plagues, wow, back to back, boom, 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 boom. No, it didn't happen that way. And some of it, there are key indicators in the text. Some of it is about the harvest time and things such as that, when certain things would occur. There are time indicators as to when that would happen. Absolutely. So, yes. Uh-huh. Priest of Midian. That's a good question. I don't know off the top of my head. Josh has been doing the scheme of redemption on Exodus and Leviticus and Numbers, so he probably has that just off the top of his head as far as what religion they were. Well, God was going to kill her son, if you remember. And by the way, if you have Moses as the primary caregiver now, and you have her son that are in danger, she's certainly going to be the one to react. As to why Moses didn't react, I'm not sure I could give a good, adequate answer to that as to why he didn't react. He's experienced the presence of God at the burning bush. He's been given instruction, and a part of that instruction was to circumcise his son. And I think that's